He was born in Ogden, Utah, and raised in Pleasant View. The mountains behind his boyhood home were like a magnet, continually drawing him in with their unfrequented canyons and old mines. On every hike, he found rocks, fascinating and mysterious rocks, colorful rocks, rocks that he felt sure were priceless. He brought these rocks home and collected them in his bedroom closet and cupboards. This began his love of geology. Dr. Koalas graduated with a bachelor's degree in geology from BYU and earned master's and doctorate degrees in geology from the University of Wisconsin. Shortly after completing his doctorate degree, Dr. Koalas joined the geology faculty at Brigham Young University, where he's been teaching for 26 years. His research interests are related to the structure and deformation of rocks and to the rates and timing of geological events. Although scientific inquiry and research can be very rewarding, Dr. Koalas most enjoys working with students and being able to see them grow in their understanding of the earth and its systems and in their testimonies of the gospel. Again, thank you very much for being here with us today, Dr. Koalas. We'll turn the time to you.
What a great sight. I was expecting about, 5 rows up here in the front. So you've already outdone what we normally do at BYU in a forum, I think. I am so honored to be with you today. I was originally scheduled to come on campus in January. They called and said, "Would you like to speak up here?" And I said, "Sure." "When?" And they said, told me January, and my mouth dropped, and I said, "I guess I'll do it." But I was thrilled when the call came a little bit later that asked me to switch my speaking time to September, because I do love Rexburg. I just wasn't looking forward to that drive from Provo up here and back in January. I love the opportunity I have as a faculty member at BYU to work with wonderful young men and women like you. When I stand in front of my classes, I can see and feel the light that radiates from your faces. It comes from you because you are good, because you're filled with that spirit that comes to all men and women who are filled with goodness. Today I want to talk to you, however, about some times of darkness, both physical and spiritual. And I hope that what I have to share with you will strengthen your testimonies and perhaps brighten the light that glows within you. To begin with, I want to discuss two of the plagues of Egypt that came at the time Moses was trying to get the children of Israel out. The Pharaoh and the Egyptians, these people were a little reluctant to let the children of Israel go. But two of them are kind of interesting to me, and if we read in Exodus, let me put these up here first, so I can figure out how to advance things. In Exodus 9, verse 23 and 24, we read, "And Moses stretched forth his rod toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and the fire ran along the ground. And the Lord rained hail upon the land of Egypt, so there was hail, and fire mingled with hail, very grievous, such as there was none like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation." And again in Exodus, a little bit later, we read, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Stretch out thine hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over all the land of Egypt, even darkness which may be felt. And Moses stretched forth his hand toward heaven, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days." In this account, I would like you to pay particular attention to a few phrases. These phrases include things like thunder and hail, That's not so unusual. Thunder and hail come together a lot of times. Fire that ran along the ground. That's a little more unusual. Hail and fire mingled with hail, such as there was none like it since Egypt became a nation. And finally, darkness that could be felt. Thick darkness. Most of you have probably witnessed a hailstorm before, and they are often accompanied by thunder. But how many of you have seen a hailstorm mingled with fire, fire that runs along the ground and is described as different from anything you have ever seen? This hailstorm, interestingly, is followed sometime later, and we don't know exactly how long, but at some period later, by thick darkness, darkness that could be felt. There is another similar account of a time of darkness found in 3 Nephi, chapter 8. In verse 5, the account says, "And it came to pass, in the 34th year, in the first month, there arose a great storm, such an one as never had been known in all the land." This account goes on to outline all the physical events that occurred at this time in some particularly descriptive language. And I want you to read through some of these items that occurred in 3 Nephi with me as well. There was a great storm, such as had never been known. There was terrible thunder, exceedingly sharp lightning, such as had never been known. And surely they'd seen a thunderstorm or a lightning storm before, but they'd never seen one like this. Cities were burning, cities sunk into the sea, cities in places where the earth was carried up on them. They were buried underneath landslides. The whole face of the land was changed. There were whirlwinds. The quaking of the earth lasted for 3 hours. Rocks and earth broken up and scattered. And finally, there was darkness that could be felt, lasting for 3 days. Now, in this list of events, in both of these accounts, there are some similarities. Get that off of there so you don't get distracted by it. There was physical and spiritual darkness, followed by spiritual and physical enlightenment. In the case of the children of Israel, Moses led them out of servitude and repression in Egypt into the desert where a pillar of fire from our Heavenly Father guarded them, and they were taught truths by a holy prophet. In the case of the Nephites and Lamanites, prior to the great darkness and destruction, the people had become very wicked, so that they were not only in darkness physically, but spiritually. And then, after the darkness, comes Christ, bringing with him light and truth. The similarities in the physical events between the two accounts include darkness that could be felt, that lasted for about 3 days, and a great storm with thunder and lightning and fire such as had never been seen before. Those are mentioned in both accounts. There are also some significant differences. In the account in Exodus, we do not hear any mention of shaking of the earth or whirlwinds or cities being destroyed or a lot of the other things that happened in the 3 Nephi account. These two events, of course, occurred on different continents at vastly different times. One occurred long before the birth of the Savior, and one occurred at his death. But in both cases, I believe there is a common theme that we can extract from them. There must be some natural phenomenon that perhaps could explain both of them. And for me, I believe there is, and I believe that this natural phenomenon is a large explosive volcanic eruption. Here's a few pictures from the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens was a beautiful, quiet mountain in the Cascades. Most of you probably weren't born back in 1980, but it seems like it was just yesterday for me. But in 1980, it began to smoke and steam a little bit. And over the next few weeks and days, this is what happened on May, forget the exact day. Glenn, do you remember what day it was? May 8th? May 18th? May 18th, 1980, the mountain blew its side out. And this cloud of ash and gas that's coming out of the mountain is traveling at several hundred miles an hour, and as it travels down across the countryside, it is heavy and dense, and it wipes out everything in its path. In addition, the side of the mountain is gone, and the side of the mountain has flowed down and across the next valley. So these photos show, I hope, just a little bit, give us perhaps a little bit of an idea of what one of these eruptions is like. Here was the mountain before, and here was the mountain afterwards. This map is a map that shows where the ash from that eruption fell. And I particularly want you to look at the red and orange areas. These show areas where the accumulation of ash from Mount St. Helens was at least a half an inch thick. Half an inch isn't much. But so it didn't get out very far, you can see, from away from Mount St. Helens, which is located here in western Washington. And you know, some of that ash made it over here into the Spokane area, Yakima, and a little bit out farther, but not much. Mount St. Helens was a fairly small eruption. Let me show you another slide here that compares Mount St. Helens with some other historic eruptions. Here's Mount St. Helens represented by the small box down here. The boxes tell us the volume of rock that has erupted from these volcanoes. So it had about 1 cubic kilometer of rock erupted out of Mount St. Helens. These other historic eruptions, Mount Pinatubo in 91, Krakatoa in 1883, was 18 times as big as Mount St. Helens. Mount Mazama, which formed Crater Lake up in Oregon, was bigger still. Tambora, the largest historic eruption in 1815, 150 cubic kilometers of rock, about 150 times the size of a Mount St. Helens. Krakatoa put enough ash up into the atmosphere that it changed the world's climate for a couple of years. It changed it so much that crops in New England froze every month of the year, including July and August. And it's interesting because that's where Joseph Smith was living in 1815 with his family, was in Vermont. And the frosts of that year, 1816, the year following this eruption, drove the Smith family out of Vermont and into New York. So in addition to volcanoes being interesting in other ways, another way they're interesting is that they help explain how the Lord gets us to move from one place to another sometimes. Well, I want to compare these eruptions now with some prehistoric eruptions that came from a spot very close to you. These come out of the Yellowstone caldera just to the north of you here. And these eruptions dwarf anything that we've seen in historic times. They are like thousands of Mount St. Helens erupting at the same time. So these eruptions can be very large when they occur. And we just hope we're never around when one of these huge ones goes off. For the Book of Mormon peoples, I don't think it would have taken a Huckleberry Ridge or a Lava Creek eruption to produce the effects that we saw, but maybe something more like Tambora or down in this range in here would have done nicely. Well, scientists who study these explosive volcanoes have learned that they are capable of producing a wide variety of natural phenomena. These things include extremely powerful winds, shaking of the earth for several hours, they didn't tell me to turn my cell phone off. Shaking of the earth for, my wife will get a kick out of that though, knowing that she called in the middle of my talk. Shaking of the earth for several hours, spectacular lightning and thunder, tsunamis, which are also called tidal waves by some people, landslides, darkness for several days. However, in order to find descriptions that are similar to what the children of Israel and the Nephites and Lamanites recorded and saw, I think that we need to look not only at the scientific literature, but also at eyewitness accounts from people who have actually experienced a similar event. Now, I don't have time today to go into all of the thousands of accounts that are available, so I've picked a few out that I hope will illuminate for you how these firsthand experiences are very similar in many ways to what we read in the Book of Mormon. Let's start with wind and fire. The winds produced by an explosive volcanic eruption are stronger and more devastating than any hurricane. Here is a beautiful city in the Caribbean. This is the town of Saint-Pierre on the island of Martinique. And sitting up above Saint-Pierre, right up here, is a volcano. It's called Mont Pelee. When Mont Pelee erupted in 1802, Saint-Pierre, and here's a picture of it in 1802, that same, looks very similar, doesn't it? Same kind of view, almost. Saint-Pierre was a busy shipping port. Typically, there would have been 20 ships, at least, in the port at any given time or more. It was a busy port because in Saint-Pierre, they produced rum, and they shipped rum all over the Western Hemisphere from Saint-Pierre. It was a city of almost 40,000 people. Here's what it looked like after the eruption. After the eruption, there were two people that were found alive. F.M. Bullard, in his book Volcanoes of the Earth, describes the power of this rush of ash and volcanic gas on and over the city of Saint-Pierre, and he said it this way, and I quote, "All the houses in Saint-Pierre were unroofed and otherwise demolished, either in part or totally. The trees were stripped of leaves and branches down to the bare trunks. The force of the blast is shown by the fact that walls of cement and stone 3 feet in thickness were torn to pieces as though made of cardboard. Century-old trees were uprooted, and a statue of the Virgin Mary, weighing at least 3 tons, was carried 50 feet from its base." Incredible, the destructive power of these volcanoes. In addition to the winds created by the volcanic blast, these kinds of volcanoes can produce whirlwinds or tornadoes, and they have been reported in many accounts. The hot ash erupting into the air is a concentrated source of heat that causes severe updrafts, providing ideal conditions for the formation of whirlwinds and tornadoes. The heat of the eruption can also create fires, as in this eyewitness account from an assistant purser by the name of Thompson, who was on board the ship Roraima in the harbor of Saint-Pierre when it erupted, when Mont Pelee erupted. Here's what he had to say, and I quote, "I saw Saint-Pierre destroyed. It was blotted out by one great flash of fire. Nearly 40,000 people were killed at once. Of 18 vessels lying in the roads, only one, the British steamship Rodham, escaped, and she, I hear, lost more than half on board. It was a dying crew that took her out. Our boat, the Roraima, arrived in Saint-Pierre early Thursday morning. For hours before we entered the roadstead, we could see flames and smoke rising from Mont Pelee. No one on board had any idea of danger." You have to think about that line for a minute, don't you? I'm not sure what they were thinking about. Captain G.T. Mugga was on bridge, and all hands got on deck to see the show. The spectacle was magnificent. As we approached Saint-Pierre, we could distinguish the rolling and leaping red flames that belched from the mountain in huge volumes and gushed high into the sky. Enormous clouds of black smoke hung over the volcano. The flames were then spurting straight up in the air, now and then waving to one side or the other, and again leaping suddenly up higher. There was a constant muffled roar. It was like the biggest oil refinery fire burning up on top of the mountain. There was a tremendous explosion at about 7:45 after we got in. The mountain was blown to pieces. There was no warning. Now think about that one again. There's always a warning. The Egyptians received a warning. The Nephites received a warning. And we receive our warnings today about how to prevent darkness in our lives. The side of the volcano, goes on this assistant purser, was ripped out, and there hurled straight towards us a solid wall of flame. This wall was composed of gas and ash, traveling like that picture I showed you from Mount St. Helens down across the countryside toward the city. There's another interesting point about the city, and that is that they were holding elections in Saint-Pierre, and some people had gotten a little bit antsy when they started to see the mountain. They saw the warning signs, and they wanted to get out, and they started leaving town. And the government didn't want that, so they set up blockades to keep people from leaving town so that they could be there for the election. Well, sometimes government does good things and sometimes they don't. But the assistant purser, Thompson, said when the mountain blew up, it sounded like 1,000 cannons. The wave of fire was on us and over us like a lightning flash. It was like a hurricane of fire. I saw it strike a cable steamship grappler broadside and capsize her. From end to end, she burst into flames and then sank. The fire rolled in mass straight down on Saint-Pierre and on the shipping, where the town vanished before our eyes. The air grew stifling hot, and we were in the thick of it. Wherever the mass of fire struck the sea, the water boiled and sent up great clouds of steam. The sea was torn into huge whirlpools that careened toward the open sea, end quote. So, fire is not a problem in a volcano. There's plenty of it available, and wind. What about lightning and thunder? Lightning and thunder such as has never been known before. Would that be possible around an erupting volcano? Well, it turns out that another common feature of explosive volcanic eruptions is lightning and thunder. These lightning displays and associated thunder, along with other noises caused by the explosions from the volcano, can be extraordinary and unusual. Here are some very recent pictures from an eruption. We can see the cloud of ash approaching, and up in here, and here's the lightning coming both out of the cloud of ash and out of the clouds above. Let's see if I've got another couple of pictures. Here's another picture of that same ash cloud. This lightning is unusual in a lot of ways, and I'll describe more for you in a moment, but here's another picture over a volcano that's erupting. The lightning is caused by the friction between the exploding ash and the air. This friction generates enormous quantities of static electricity that is then discharged as lightning. The thunder from the lightning is supplemented by the explosions from the volcano and the earthquakes that occur almost continuously during some eruptions. Many eyewitnesses mention this phenomenon. For example, during the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa, Captain Logan, on board a ship called the Berbice in the Sunda Straits, described it this way, and I quote, "The lightning and thunder became worse and worse. The lightning and thunder became worse and worse. The lightning flashes shot past and around the ship. Fireballs continually fell on the deck and burst into sparks." These fireballs were actually balls of electricity. "We saw flashes of lightning fall quite close to us on the ship, heard fearful rumblings and explosions, sometimes upon the deck, sometimes among the rigging. The man at the wheel felt strong electric shocks on one arm. The copper sheathing of the rudder became glowing from electric discharges. Fiery phenomena on board the ship manifest themselves at every moment," end quote. During the eruption of Mount St. Helens back in 1980 again, Lightning and other phenomena were associated with the eruption were so spectacular that many eyewitnesses mentioned them. Beneath any part of the eruptive cloud, radios became useless because of the static. Some of the lightning that came from the cloud didn't appear like normal lightning. It was red in color instead of typical lightning color. Some people would say first a white dot would appear in the cloud and then a bolt would shoot out from it. Other lightning came in ball form. Have you ever heard of ball lightning before? This occurs around erupting volcanoes. Streaking toward the ground, connected neither with the ground nor with the cloud. One eyewitness said that after the cloud passed overhead, lots of lightning started 600 to 800 feet in the air, forming big balls as big as a pickup truck. And then it would come down and hit the ground and just bounce and roll. Incredible. Not typical lightning. You don't see that in most lightning storms and thunderstorms, right? One additional thing we can learn from the descriptions and photos of lightning and thunder around explosive volcanic eruptions is that these phenomena often occur without rainfall, so that the wood for fires could still be exceedingly dry, as mentioned in the Book of Mormon. The reason the fires could not be lit is because of the smothering effect of the falling volcanic ash, which can accumulate to several inches in thickness very rapidly, even at considerable distances from the volcano. In 1883, when Krakatoa erupted, the Bierink family was living in a village about 15 miles from the volcano. When they finished with the eruption and were able to go out and look, their home was the only one left standing in the village. Mrs. Bierink left this account. Someone, she said, burst into the house shouting, "Shut the doors, shut the doors." Suddenly, it was pitch dark. The last thing I saw was ash being pushed up through the cracks in the floorboards like a fountain. There was still deep darkness. We couldn't light a fire, as matches went out immediately. The thunderous noises produced by an eruption may carry for distances of several hundred miles. In April of 1815, one of the most frightful eruptions recorded in history occurred in the mountain Tambora in the island of Sumbawa in Indonesia. The sound of the explosions was heard in Sumatra at a distance of 970 miles in a direct line and at Ternate in an opposite direction at a distance of 720 miles. The area over which tremulous noises and other volcanic effects extended was 1,000 English miles in circumference. Shaking of the earth is another phenomenon that is recorded in the Book of Mormon. It was observed by them, but not by the people in Egypt. This may be because the volcano that erupted near the Book of Mormon peoples was much closer than the volcano, if there was a volcano, that erupted for the Egyptians. Shaking lasting for several hours is not unusual. However, several hours of shaking are too long of a time period to be caused by a single large earthquake. Have any of you been in earthquakes before? How long do they last? Well, a few seconds, maybe a minute, but not 3 hours. Volcanoes, when they erupt, however, can produce shaking that will last for a long period of time. This is very reasonable for the initial stages of an eruption. We might call this the throat clearing stage, when the volcano is cleaning out its vent of the rock and debris that's plugged it up for some time. For example, during the eruption of Krakatoa, the shaking of the earth lasted throughout the night on August 26, 1883, and on into the next morning. There was so much energy released during the Krakatoa eruption, remember this one's about 18 times the size of Mount St. Helens, that it has been estimated to be the equivalent of 20,000 atomic bombs going off all at once. So shaking is not something we would have a problem with for a volcanic eruption. What about darkness, the darkness that you can feel, which was described in both the Egyptian in the Old Testament account and in the Book of Mormon account. Well, darkness caused by falling ash from the volcano is another feature that commonly occurs. Ooh. During the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens, Sergeant Larry Gamash of the Yakima County Sheriff's Office reported that it was just like midnight in the middle of the afternoon. All the street lights and the neon lights turned on. In another volcanic eruption in Russia, the Bezemeny volcano in eastern Russia, a witness described it this way. He said the darkness was so impenetrably dark that one could not see his own hand when held up to his face. And the cloud of darkness was described as very thick and tangible, almost heavy. Mount Tambora, which we've talked about as well, they're trying to confuse me with changing the lighting here on us as we go through this. Mount Tambora was reduced in height by over 4,000 feet when it erupted in 1815. And the darkness that it occasioned in the daytime was so profound that witnesses described it as equal to nothing that they had ever seen in the darkest night. It was impossible to see your hand when held up close to the eye. And the total darkness around the volcano lasted for 3 days within 200 miles of the volcano. Sound familiar? Well, what about the destruction of cities and towns? We've already seen by looking at the description earlier of St. Pierre one way that cities can be destroyed, and that's by the hot cloud of gas and ash that comes down over the city. Another way a city can be destroyed is simply by being buried in the ash. The city of Pompeii was buried in the ash around Mount Vesuvius, and those that didn't get out were buried right in the ash itself, and we today can see them in their dying positions in these casts that have been created from the voids left in the ash. Here's another tragic city. This is the city of Armero in Colombia, and it was buried under a volcanic mudflow. The volcano is not even in the picture. It's several tens of miles away. But the mud and debris created on top of the volcano flowed down this valley and out across this city of Armero, killing 26,000 people. They were all sleeping in their beds at night. Some of them that survived had to wait days and days for help to arrive. This one young girl here by the name of Omaya Sanchez, I believe, something like that, Omaira Sanchez, was trapped in the mud for about 4 days before she finally died, and they did not get to her in time to rescue her. Well, another way that cities can be destroyed is by tidal wave or tsunami. During the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa, an island volcano off the coast of Java, 165 villages were completely destroyed, and 132 were partly destroyed, killing about 33,000 people. Waves crashing on the shores near Krakatoa reached heights of over 130 feet. I just brought a couple of pictures. I didn't have any pictures of Krakatoa because that was back in 1883, but here are a couple of pictures of what a tsunami can do. Recently, these pictures are from Indonesia and happened after an earthquake, not a volcano, but both volcanoes and earthquakes can produce the same kind of effect. Before the tsunami of June 23rd, 2004, here's what this little town city looked like, and there it is after. One elderly Dutchman in 1883 reported what the tidal wave was like in Java. He said, the eruption, and I quote, began on Sunday afternoon. We did not take much notice at first. Again, I'm not sure why people don't pay attention to volcanoes, but they don't. until we noticed that Krakatoa was completely enveloped in smoke. Afterwards came on the thick darkness, so black and intense that I could not see my hand held before my eyes. That seems to be a typical way they like to describe this darkness. Can't see my hand. Krakatoa was 23 miles away, and even though it was that far away, the concussions and vibrations from the constantly repeated shocks were most terrifying. Many of the houses shook so much that we feared every minute would bring them down. There was little sleep for any of us that dreadful night. Before daybreak on Monday, on going out of doors, I found the shower of ashes had commenced, and this increased in force until at length large pieces of pumice stone started to fall. About 6 a.m., I was walking along the beach. There was no sign of the sun, as usual, and the sky had a dull, depressing look. Some of the darkness of the previous day had cleared off, but it was not very light even then. Looking out to sea, I noticed a dark black object through the gloom traveling towards the shore. At first sight, it seemed like a low range of hills rising out of the water, but I knew that there was nothing of that kind in that part of the strait. A second glance, and a very hurried one it was, convinced me that it was a lofty ridge of water many feet high, and still worse, that it would break soon upon the coast near the town. There was no time to give any warning, and so I turned and ran for my life. My running days are long since over. But you may be sure that I did my best. In a few minutes, I heard water with a loud roar break upon the shore. Everything was engulfed. Another glance around showed the houses being swept away and the trees thrown down on every side. Breathless and exhausted, I still pressed on. As I heard the rushing waters behind me, I knew it was a race for life. Struggling on a few more yards brought me to some rising ground, and here the torrent of water overtook me. I gave up all for lost, as I saw with dismay how high the wave still was. I was soon taken off my feet and borne inland by the force of the resistless mass. I remembered nothing more until a violent blow aroused me. Some hard, firm substance seemed within my reach, and clutching it, I found I had gained a place of safety. The waters swept past, and I found myself clinging to a coconut palm tree. Most of the trees near the town had been thrown down and uprooted for miles, but this one, fortunately, had escaped, and myself with it. The huge wave rolled on, gradually decreasing in height and strength until the mountain slopes at the back of Anger were reached, and then, its fury spent, the waters gradually receded and flowed back into the sea. The sight of those receding waters haunts me still. As I clung to the palm tree, wet and exhausted, there floated past the dead bodies of many a friend and neighbor. Only a mere handful of the population escaped. Houses and streets were completely destroyed, and scarcely a trace remains of where the once busy, thriving town originally stood. So water destruction certainly is a possibility in these volcanoes. If I had time, I could go into many other accounts and provide you with eyewitness accounts of every one of the features that you read about in that Book of Mormon account in 3rd Nephi. Today, however, I'm getting ahead of myself. But what is the real point here? Today, more than ever, those who want to destroy your testimony, those who want to extinguish the light within you and plunge you into darkness, and there are more than just a few of these out there in the world, these people are attacking the Book of Mormon and its historicity. So what is so remarkable about an account of a volcano in the Book of Mormon? No doubt the naysayers would propose that Joseph Smith simply read the account of a volcanic eruption, thought this would make a great backdrop for the destruction he had planned for the time of Christ's death, and threw that in. They might even point out the similarities to the Exodus account. However, I would answer that the Book of Mormon account is remarkable in many ways. First of all, it's remarkable for its detail and accuracy. It is quite different from the Exodus account in so many ways. And that such an account as that as what we find in the Book of Mormon, would have been impossible for an uneducated young man to write in 1830. Geology was a science still in its infancy in 1830 and not well understood. The first textbook of geology was published in 1830, the same year as the Book of Mormon, written by Charles Lyell in Great Britain. If we go to Charles Lyell's book and look at descriptions of volcanic eruptions, his list of features is quite incomplete when compared to what we find in the Book of Mormon. So I don't believe there's any place that Joseph Smith could have gone to have determined what to put in that account if he was trying to write it for himself. For me, this strengthens my testimony of this wonderful book. It doesn't make my testimony of the book. That comes from taking Moroni's challenge and praying about the book and asking Heavenly Father if it's true. And if you do that, you'll know that it's true. But it certainly doesn't hurt to have these other evidences that help us to see that the book is remarkable. I believe there's an even greater lesson to be learned here, however. When you leave this great university, you'll be challenged many times throughout your life by those who do not believe. You may be tempted to join them. If you do, I can promise you that the light of the Spirit that burns so bright within you today will go out and will turn to darkness. It is a darkness that can be felt. Felt by those who know you and by you yourself. It is a terrible thing to see that light go out in someone that you know and love. And it is not death that extinguishes it, but it is sin and doubt and anger and envy. I've seen it happen in lives of some of my closest friends. On the other hand, if you keep your testimony strong, if you stay close to the Spirit, others will see in you the gospel light, and it will be a beacon to the world. It is a light that can dispel the darkness. You can be an incredible force for good just by being who you are. I hope you'll forgive me for taking just a moment to emphasize this point with a personal example. The power of the light that you have as a beacon to those in the world who are not members of the church, many of whom have never seen someone like you. And when they see you, they don't quite understand it. My wife and I don't watch a lot of TV, but we have enjoyed watching American Idol the last few seasons. This past year, as most of you know, there were two wonderful young LDS singers participating in that competition, and I was so proud of how they performed. Both Brooke White and David Archuleta represented the church well. Now, I don't know either of these two young people well, but my wife and I have become acquainted with David Archuleta's families and friends. David, I took the picture myself, so. David is a 17-year-old active member of the church from Murray, Utah, and is normally somewhat shy. He is also humble, caring, and a polite young man. Even with all the accolades he has received, he still finds it hard to believe that anyone really likes to listen to him sing. During the American Idol competition, and as he has toured the country, many, many people have been drawn to him because they saw in him something they didn't quite understand. Just like most of you, David glows. One of the judges in the competition even mentioned it during the show. You can guess who, she said. She said, "David, you have a glorious aura about you." Well, I don't have time again to go into great detail, but just with my wife's and my limited knowledge of events, we know of a middle-aged woman shown here. Her name is Sue from New York, who was so touched by David that she let two Mormon elders into her home, not knowing at the time that they belonged to the same faith as David did. She was baptized in May and spent a week at our home in July. We know of a talented young man, the same age as David. And that's him right there. Name's Cody, from Arizona. Cody grew up without a father and with very little guidance from his mother. He found, however, this past year, a way to get to Utah. Not only did he find a way to get to Utah, but he found a way to be taken in by the Archuletas. So this is the Archuletas' house, and he was staying there with them. And the first thing they did when David came to their home was invite the missionaries over. And Cody has now been baptized, and we were privileged to go to his baptismal service in July. We know of a young lady in Mississippi, this young lady by the name of Lina, who grew up in an abusive home and knows really very little about religion, but she saw something she couldn't explain in David. She stayed with us for a few days in May, and we were able to take her to Temple Square and to church, and she's currently taking the missionary discussions and reading the Book of Mormon. We know of a 35-year-old man in Texas, a middle-aged lady in Arizona, another young college student in Tennessee, a woman in Canada, and there are many others, all who are now either investigating the church or already baptized because they saw something different in this young man. None of these people fall into the category of young teenaged girls that the news media tells us comprise the bulk of David's fans. To accomplish this, all David has done is be himself, remain true to himself. He hasn't been preachy or pushy about the gospel. He hasn't mentioned the church very much except when asked directly about it. Well, the reason I share this with you is because I believe that each of you, by staying true to the principles of the gospel and by allowing your light to shine, can and will have the same kind of impact on those that you work with and meet throughout the world. The world today is in darkness, and according to what I read in the news, it's getting darker. More than ever, your light is needed to shine forth as a rescue beacon to those who are seeking the truth. I know, and I want you to know, that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God, that Joseph Smith was a prophet, and that we have a prophet on the earth today who leads and guides us. I want you to know how special you are. And as you know, the Savior has told you and told us that we are the light of the world, that we need to let our light shine so that the darkness of the world can see the light that we have. It is my prayer that we can all let our light shine before men, that those who are out there in the darkness may see. And I leave this with you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Sorry about the phone.
We'd like to thank Dr. Koalas for being here with us for his message. We'll stand adjourned. We don't close forums with prayer. So thank you very much for coming and the spirit that you brought with you. We'll take about a 7 or 8 minute break, and then we'll begin the question and answer period. If you'd like to ask Dr. Koalas a question, or you'd like to participate in that, come to the front. We'll have microphones on either side. Thank you again. All you have to do is we're going to turn the mic back over to Brother Koalas, and then if you have a question, come to one of the mics. It's very important because these are recorded, and we want to save your question and the answer for posterity. Think of it like that. We'll go for half an hour or so, and we'll see how we're doing. Go ahead.
Thank you, Brother Packer. Actually, I think they record it and send this to Salt Lake, and then if you said anything you shouldn't have, watch out. So are there any questions? It's like testimony meeting.
When I was on my mission, I was reading in the book of Helaman, and a scripture stood out to me one time. And what immediately came to my mind was plate tectonics. And that scripture, it's in correlation to 3 Nephi in the account of the death of Christ. And it's when Samuel the Lamanite is on the wall giving the signs to the people of the death of Christ, when he talks about the rocks being broken on top of the earth and beneath. He says, which we know now are, or the most part, are one solid piece, and which after they will forever be found in cracks and in smaller pieces. I was wondering if you had ever...
That's one of the things I didn't get to talk about, but that's a a very good point. Volcanoes, again, are very good at breaking rocks up into bits and pieces and scattering them far and wide, where afterwards they can be found everywhere, in cracks, in crevices, in on top of houses, everywhere. When you mention plate tectonics, I think it is related to plate tectonics, because in order to have this kind of a volcano, they only occur in two kinds of plate tectonic settings. One is at a place we call a subduction zone, and the other is in another kind of setting we call hotspots, continental hotspots, like Yellowstone. Yellowstone's a continental hotspot. It could produce this kind of an eruption. Mount St. Helens and Mount Tambora and Krakatoa, those were all on subduction zones. And if we believe what some of the Book of Mormon scholars have written about where the Book of Mormon peoples possibly lived, most of the ones that I have discussed this with feel that they lived somewhere in Mexico, Central America region, because that's where we find high-level civilizations. Excuse me. Maybe I'll be able to talk. So these kinds of civilizations, in order to find a place where this could have happened, we would look for a civilization that had language, had records, had writing. Those kinds of civilizations we find in Central America and in some places in South America. But they also occur along subduction zones. So perfect place for one of these kinds of volcanoes to erupt. One place we don't find these kind of volcanoes is in New York State. So how do we explain that in relation to the Hill Cumorah being in New York State? Well, again, I'm not the scholar probably that's the expert on this, but those who are feel that there are two Hill Cumorahs, one that was mentioned in the record in the Book of Mormon, and another one in New York State, which has been was the repository for the records for many years. But it may not be the Hill Cumorah that was necessarily mentioned in the Book of Mormon itself. That's not my view. That's just some of the people at BYU that study those things. That's what their take on it is. Other questions? Yes.
I recently returned from Chile, where, as you probably know, there was a volcanic eruption just a few months ago in southern Chile. I was wondering, what magnitude, how's that compared to other volcanic eruptions that we've looked at today?
Again, that one was a pretty good one. It wasn't as big as Mount Tambora or Krakatoa, but it was a fairly good eruption. Actually, I think some of these pictures that I showed you of the lightning today come from that eruption. I don't know, does any of you know any more about that one down there in southern Chile recently? But that's certainly on a subduction zone, yes.
My question pertains kind of to the effects of like Krakatoa erupting and the effects that it has kind of on the environment and the atmosphere. I don't know where it came from. It was before our mission, so a few years back, I had heard the effects of Krakatoa offsetting the seasons and things almost took our kind of environment through a cycle. Now, with the environment the way it is now, people and talking of global warming, could a volcanic eruption offset that and in a way, almost reset that cycle back to what we are normally used to?
The short answer to that is probably not. With a volcanic eruption, you get a lot of the major thing that can affect the climate is the ash that gets up high in the atmosphere and blocks some of the sunlight out. And that can cause a cooling of the climate. But the ash cleans out of the atmosphere within a year or two, and the climate appears to go back after that to its normal time period. Now, if we had a Yellowstone-like eruption, I don't know what the effect that would have on things. That's a huge thing, and we haven't had anything like that in historic times. And it may put enough, in addition to the ash that comes out of a volcano, you also do get some greenhouse gases that come out. You get carbon dioxide, and you get some sulfur dioxide and some other things that could affect it the other way. But most of the studies that have looked at these explosive volcanic eruptions and their effects on the climate have shown that there is a little cooling that goes on in the climate for a year or two after the eruption, and then it seems to go back to normal.
I have two questions. My first one is, is the reason that the Yellowstone eruptions were so much worse than the other ones, or is it because it's in a hot spot instead of the other zone you were talking about?
That's certainly one of the factors. It is in these hot spots, it seems to be one of the places where we can get these enormous kinds of eruptions, although we get some pretty big ones in subduction settings as well. But that could be one of the reasons, yeah. Okay.
And my other question was, during the talk you explained that the friction causes the lightning. What in a volcanic eruption would cause a tornado to happen?
Again, when you get a tornado is caused by wind shear, when you get winds moving in different directions very rapidly, and when you get all that ash moving up vertically and air around it being pushed aside, you can create the kind of conditions that we need to have a tornado.
Thank you.
Hi. This is going to sound like an attack, but I swear it's not. I'm just curious if there's been research done, if there has been any research as to any of the scale of like that type of eruptions in like Central or South America around the time of Christ, or if they're any near enough to Egypt to actually cause that. I'm just wondering what kind of.
Ben, do you want to answer that?
Actually, thanks to Bart, I did that very study, looking at ice cores that were extracted from Antarctica and Greenland, looking at volcanic evidence for volcanic eruptions, because as Bart mentioned, you get sulfur dioxide, and if you mix sulfur dioxide with water, you get sulfuric acid. And so by taking these ice cores, you can look at the layers and look for the acidic layers that represent volcanic eruptions. There is actually evidence that within the window of time that I looked at, which was about 10 to 20 years around the time of Christ's death, there are volcanic evidences. That being said, there's a little problem, and that for most of those, there's an error of plus or minus 30 years. And within that margin of error, there's also another famous eruption called Mount Vesuvius and Pompeii, which was in AD 49. And so the issue is that although there is evidence that, yes, there were volcanic eruptions in that time period, you can't pinpoint the exact location of what and which volcano produced those deposits. But you couldn't have an anti-Mormon come up and say, oh, the Book of Mormon is not true because there's no evidence for, you know, in that. There is. The problem is that we can't say, you know, this was in Central America or someplace else.
It's not precise enough. As far as the Egyptian thing goes, and back in the Old Testament, there are some suggestions, some people have suggested that perhaps that was associated with the eruption of Santorini out in the Mediterranean, but the timing seems a little bit off. There are other volcanoes in the Mediterranean that certainly are distant enough from Egypt that they could have created darkness and the effects that were seen there and still not have caused shaking and the great destruction that we saw in the Book of Mormon account. So in Egypt itself, there aren't any volcanoes, active volcanoes that I know of. Are there? But we get up on the other side of the Mediterranean, and there are lots of them that could have produced a similar kind of thing. This side's been a little bit lax in their questions.
Well, along with the Egyptian thing, it says in the scriptures that the Israelites were able to use lights in their homes. Can you explain that?
Yeah, again, it's not always that you can't have light during an eruption. Mm-hmm. It's just that if you're close enough to the volcano, the ash is falling heavily enough that it smothers fires as quickly as you try to light them. If you're inside of a building where you can keep the ash out, you might be able to light a fire.
Okay.
Good question.
You've talked about bigger sized volcanic eruptions like what you'd have at Yellowstone or Island Park and then the smaller. What about simultaneous? Are there instances where you have that we show that there's been two volcanoes or three that have gone off about the same time period?
The answer to that is yes. There has been some, there is some evidence that perhaps, I think this was in the Caribbean, I read an account of a couple of volcanoes there that one of them went off one week and another one went off the next week, and they seem to have some interconnection. But it's rare. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen, though. But it's not a common thing, but it could happen. I don't think you need more than one volcano. And this, again, is the gospel according to Koalas. So use it for what it's worth. But my personal feeling is that the area that the Book of Mormon peoples lived in was not large. We're not talking about all of North and South America at that time. And when we read the accounts of how long it took them to traverse by foot back and forth from here or there, it seems like it was not a huge area. And so it wouldn't require multiple volcanoes. This could easily have been accomplished by one.
Hi there. Hi. I just got back from Central America. I served a mission in Honduras. And there's lots of ruins and things in Guatemala. But I'm just curious, like, the shape of Central America is a little different, like, in the coastline and things. I'm curious, like, if it's possible that a volcano could have happened there, and it just blew away so much that it just took out
changed
that whole,
the whole area.
It just changed the whole land.
You know, that's, again, a good friend of mine, John Sorensen, Dr. Sorensen at BYU, who's an archaeologist, has studied the geography of the Book of Mormon, and he's written a whole book on it. You should read it sometime. But he doesn't find that there's any problem with the shape of Central America with the description in Book of Mormon. In fact, he thinks it fits very well. And you'd have to look at his maps to see how he thinks it fits into that picture. But he has it, you know, and again, it's just a theory, because we haven't found Nephi's name somewhere yet. I'd like to, but we haven't found it yet.
I was just wondering how long it took you to find your research and everything to write this up.
Well, you know, I had been, and probably I was talking to Dr. Embry today, and he'd been doing the same thing. Over a number of years, I had kind of been collecting little stories and bits of information on these kinds of volcanoes, because I kind of recognized what that Book of Mormon account was describing, and I thought, I need to write this up sometime. And so... this was about 15 years ago. I decided I'm going to sit down and put this together into a paper that was published in the BYU Studies back then. And I spent some time in the library, but it was, you know, it was just a couple of weeks, again, tidying up my notes and trying to put it together into a volume that made sense, I hope, into a paper that made sense. So it wasn't too bad. Wasn't as bad as writing some of the papers I've written in other journals. Although that BYU Studies people, they are very picky about their references, let me tell you that. They spent hours going over my references, making sure I wasn't lying to them. Any other questions? Nobody wants to ask about David Archuleta, huh? I'm sorry. No, that's good.
Mine's just kind of a clarifying question. I couldn't remember. You said in the Egypt part, was there actually parts where they said there's fire walking on the ground in that part? And if so, like, was that lava you're talking about? And if
I don't think it was lava in Egypt again. I think what they were describing there fits very nicely with the unusual kind of lightning that we get in some of these ash storms. And they talk about the fire running along the ground. It sounds a lot like the ball lightning that people saw in around Mount St. Helens that was rolling along the ground. And that's just my theory again. But I don't think that's a bad idea, because most hailstorms are not like that. You don't get, you know, this fire and hail going together. That's a little bit unusual.
It is seen that there's always been a lot of volcanic activity throughout the ages. What are we expecting here for the future? Or about the same?
Well, right now, I don't know. Has anybody here studied the forecast for the future of volcanoes? As far as we know, the volcanoes are going to continue to erupt, and they're not... You know, not extremely common things. You know, small eruptions are pretty common. And certain types of volcanoes erupt almost continuously. So if you go to Hawaii, for example, the big island of Hawaii, the volcano there has been erupting, Kilauea, almost continuously for 30 years. How long? Since 1983. It's been erupting continuously. So some places... No question, it's very common. But that's not the kind of eruption we're talking about. We're talking about one of these volcanoes that kind of gets constipated a little bit. And when it blows off, it really blows off. And Mount St. Helens is that kind. All the Cascade volcanoes, the ones down through the Andes Mountains. Yellowstone, of course, is a good spot for that sort of thing. There are a number of others around the world. But they don't happen, they're not extremely common, but they do happen. You know, in my lifetime, there have been, you know, it seems like one a year almost erupts someplace. But they're not huge eruptions. They're smaller eruptions. To get these really huge eruptions, like a Mount Tambora, well, we've only had one in historic times. And that was in 1815. To have one like Yellowstone, the last time Yellowstone erupted was 600,000 years ago. So not real common. But they do happen. Yes?
I'm just wondering how many volcanoes there are in Central America that are about that size and are still active that could have caused that.
Boy, I should have Ben answer that one again. Any idea? There are a lot of them. The interesting thing is, and I've done a little additional work looking at some of the archaeological sites in Central America. And there are a couple of very well-documented now cases where one of them was in El Salvador, for example. In El Salvador, there's a volcano called Ilopango or something like that. And it erupted, a very large eruption, and wiped out the civilization that was around it. And in the ruins around this area, they have been digging, and they always find this layer of ash that has buried this civilization in El Salvador. And there was another one, too. I can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head. But there's so much down there in Central America that has not been even looked at archaeologically. So, I mean, the volume of sites that are yet to be studied is enormous. And so to say, well, where is the place we're talking about, it's a difficult thing to do right at this point in time.
Okay, I had a couple questions.
Yes.
First, is it common once a volcano has gone off, is it common for it to happen again?
Volcanoes erupt.
Like the same volcano?
The same volcano certainly can erupt more than once, yes.
And has there been some? I'm not knowledgeable in this area, but has there been some volcanoes that have
erupted? Have erupted more than once?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know?
What, Ben, can you think of one that's erupted more than once in historic times? Smaller eruptions since then. It hasn't had another cataclysmic eruption. I was trying to think of one that has maybe erupted twice like that. Those are more long-term kinds of things, but... You have to put the lid back on the pressure cooker, so to speak, and until you do that, it gas and material continues to escape. It won't have one of those kind of eruptions. Now, there was some place that I was thinking had at least two of these kinds of eruptions, but probably not. Okay. Not in historic times that I can think of.
Okay. And then the other question.
Glenn, did you have a candidate? Okay. But not these, not the
not
big.
That scale tends to be on the order of centuries. And so for any given volcano, you say, well, we've had St. Helens 150 years with the eruptions, and those are all.
Yeah, if we ignore whether it was historic or not, then we can go back and we can look at the deposits.
Are built by
right. I thought, now here's one, I think, hasn't Colima volcano erupted multiple times in historic?
I don't know about that one, but I know that Popocatépetl, Popo in Mexico City has had a few large eruptions, not in the recent decade, but there have been.
But while the Aztecs were living there, they certainly did.
And the other one, I think, is Montserrat.
That's right, Montserrat, which erupted, just about destroyed the island the last time, or chased everybody off of it anyway.
Okay, and then my other question was, a couple times while you were speaking, you said that you couldn't go into quite as much detail because of time. Is there?
Yeah, I wrote a bigger article on this so that you could go and read it. If you have some specific event that you'd like me to talk more about, we could certainly do that. But I had lots more in my article. I have a lot more eyewitness accounts of people who have seen these kinds of eruptions.
Yeah, I was curious, is there a way, do you have it online?
It's actually online. If you search for the BYU Studies through the BYU Library. Don't go to the BYU Studies site because they won't tell you that it's there. But if you go through the BYU Library, they have it online and you can go in and download the old issues.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
It's in there.
Just a question on the volcanoes and stuff by Egypt. Now, are the volcanoes north of the Mediterranean Sea, or are they south or east or west?
They're mostly north, so up in Italy and Greece, and some out in the Mediterranean itself. The island of Santorini was kind of out in the Mediterranean, and is now all that's left of it is kind of a little rim of an island.
Okay, and now
other people have proposed that was the site of Atlantis. And Atlantis sunk into the sea.
And now with the plate tectonics, could those plates have moved away from Egypt and everything and caused to open? I know there's lots of places where the mountains have formed and over time an earthquake has caused the mountains to open up and everything else.
Certainly the plates are moving, but the rate at which they are moving is so slow that even between the time of Moses in our time, we hardly notice any difference in the shapes of the coastlines or where countries are located. So in historical records, we know pretty much how big the Mediterranean was back at that time, and it hasn't changed much since then.
All right, thank you.
Yep.
Hi, it's me again.
Yes.
I was in Nicaragua, and I was able to see three of the major volcanoes that are there. And especially the one, it's called Volcan Masaya, where you can walk right up to the ridge and you can see into the earth until you can't see anymore. And it's kind of scary to stand there. But also understanding that Lake Nicaragua was formed by volcanic activity. Do you know much about those events or are they in any way correlated with the...
Book of Mormon thing.
Yeah, with the destruction.
Again, as Dr. Jordan mentioned, we can't fingerprint or point our finger at any one eruption for what happened in the Book of Mormon. But yes, there are a lot of large eruptions that have happened in Central America in the past. Lake Nicaragua, I think, is probably too old if there was an eruption that formed that lake. Do you know anything about the formation of... So, yeah, we can't fingerprint, can't point our finger at anyone. Yeah. Yeah.
There's certainly lots of volcanoes around the lake. You have a tsunami in one of the lakes because of the volcanoes all around.
And you can have landslides around, in many places in Central America around these volcanoes because they're generally in fairly steep terrain that is likely to slip or fall or fail during a lot of shaking. So,
now, obviously, before it erupts, sometimes we have signs like the rumbling of the earth and the smoke and fire occasionally, but before those signs, have scientists been able to figure out a way to predict those eruptions?
You know, we're getting much better at it today. Ever since the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980, when we didn't understand things very well, but that mountain helped in a lot of ways because there were a lot of instruments that were put around the mountain to monitor what was going on in the mountain, and we have discovered some things that really do help us now to identify when magma is moving inside the earth. And in order to get the pressure in the volcano, we need to have the magma kind of moving up underneath the volcano. And so there are characteristic kinds of earthquakes that are produced as magma moves up through the pipes that it moves through in the earth. And it's almost like a sound wave moving through an organ pipe. It produces a harmonic wave that can be recognized at the surface as magma moving inside the earth.
And that's how they monitor that?
And they do monitor that very closely now. In fact, back a few years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey was monitoring another place we worry about in California called the Long Valley Caldera area, and they saw some of these characteristic earthquakes that suggested magma was moving up through the ground. Right next to Long Valley, there's a ski resort called Mammoth. Is it just called Mammoth? And, of course, they told everybody to evacuate and get out and this because there could be a possible eruption. And then after a couple of weeks, the earthquake activity died down and stopped and nothing happened. And everybody was just completely upset that they'd chased off all their tourists trying to warn them that the volcano was going to occur. And so then a year or two after that, Hollywood came out with a movie that you should watch sometime if you haven't. It's called Dante's Peak, where, you know, we warn people, we don't warn people. What do? You just never know.
So you mentioned that there were two survivors of that city when the volcano exploded. What should you do when a volcano explodes in your backyard?
What should you do? Well, again, you should do what those people were trying to do in Saint-Pierre, and that was escape. And unfortunately, the politicians and others were keeping them there. The two people that survived, one was a prisoner in a jail, kind of underground, and the other one was out on the fringe of town, if I understand it right. He was in a house where everybody else suffocated and died, and somehow he fell on a bed or something and managed to come back, have enough oxygen. So one of the ways people die is by suffocation in these eruptions as well, and he managed to have enough breath, I guess, that he came back too after the eruption, and everybody else in the room was dead. So
more of a stroke of luck than anything else.
Pretty lucky, yeah. But, you know, in the Book of Mormon, it talks about this person being struck down and that person not being struck down. Volcanoes are very good at that. This person can be hit with a rock on the head, and that person will live. And they can be standing right next to each other. I have accounts of this happening in eyewitness accounts where There was one lady, for example, who was holding her baby in Japan around one of these erupting volcanoes, and the baby was struck in the head and killed immediately, and she was okay. But that kind of thing is very... So if you're a wicked person and the Lord wants to get you, you know, there may be a rock out there with your name on it.
I have a question about the people in Pompeii. They were buried in ash, and you see how they were right before they died, but why is it that you don't see any form of struggle as they were suffocating? Why is it that you see them, like, holding one another or moving as if they just froze?
Has anybody been suffocated before? Close? No. Some of them they did find had struggled and tried to get out, actually. I read an account once, and maybe one of you can correct me, but there was a thief that had gone back into the town and had been robbing jewelry and gold or whatever out of some of the homes that had been deserted, and he got caught in the ash, and they found him struggling but with the bag of money still with him. But many of them were inside buildings where they were somewhat initially protected, I think, from the ash, and they thought they were going to be okay, and they sat there, and as they stayed there longer and longer, the ash built up to such levels and eventually swamped the house and them too. There was no way for them to struggle and get away. Does anybody have any more information? Anybody been to Pompeii? Glenn, did they tell you anything when you went to Pompeii? Yeah, we had a guy that came and talked to us in our department a couple of years ago who's from Italy, an Italian scientist, and he talked about how fast the ash fall was in some parts of Pompeii. And, you know, because there were some that survived the initial ash flow, and they didn't get out. They thought they were going to survive. Yeah. But I've always wondered how these guys, you know, end up propped up on their elbow or you know, into the ash or something. Yeah. A lot of them were found in kind of fetal position, so they kind of curl up into a ball. I don't know if that's typical when you suffocate or not, but... And it killed them. Yeah. Yeah. You have so many experts here. It's just that's the great thing.
I was just wondering, with the Savior's death in Jerusalem at Golgotha, there was record of an earthquake happening mm-hmm. there. Could that have affected at all a volcano?
Well, you know, it's a long ways away on the other side of the earth, but I don't know the inner workings of connections of things. So I don't know the answer to that question. All we do know is that when it, you know, the Book of Mormon account says the whole face of the earth was changed at the time of this destruction. And one of the things that I would emphasize to you is that when they say that, they're not talking about the whole planet. They're not even talking about all of North and South America. We know the whole planet didn't change mm-hmm. because people in the old world went on their way just like they always had after Christ's death. They didn't notice any difference, and Rome was still in the same place and everybody else. And in the New World, even in the Book of Mormon account, it still talks about places that were there before Christ's death, and they're still there after Christ's death. But the thing that's interesting is that when you read some of the eyewitness accounts of people who have survived and then go out and look at the terrain after one of these volcanic eruptions, they use that same kind of language. They say the whole land has changed, the whole face of the earth has changed. It's not, it's different. It doesn't look anything like it did the day before.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Just dramatic difference, yes.
Okay, so I was wondering with Pompeii, One time in a geology class, we watched a documentary on Lake Nyos in Cameroon. And if I remember right, the people who came into Cameroon after, you know, communication ceased, like, what's going on? They went to see. They said that it looked like people had just lain down and fallen asleep. There wasn't really anything that...
And that's a little different. That wasn't a volcanic eruption. That was a kind of a turnover of the lake. There was carbon dioxide trapped down at the bottom of the lake, and the lake waters, the cold water down deep was replaced by, I guess, some colder water up here that sank down, and the lake turned over, and all that gas escaped very quickly. And carbon dioxide, as was mentioned, is heavier than air, and it hung down near the ground and suffocated the cattle and people that were in that region. But you're right, they were suffocating just like the people at Pompeii, and so they kind of fell down and went to sleep, right? Just looked like they were sleeping. I'm sure that's kind of the way it feels. You kind of get groggy, and next thing you know, you're dead. Is that it? Yes.
Yeah, in the scriptural accounts, hail was mentioned, and I'm not sure if you went over that in the volcano.
Certainly was mentioned in the Exodus account. I don't know that it mentions it in the Book of Mormon account, but in the Exodus account it does. And again, whenever we get turbulence in the atmosphere and we get cold air and warm air or mixing, you can get hail produced, and we do get rain sometimes with these ash storms as well, so it will stimulate rain in the atmosphere, but it doesn't happen all the time, and that's why I think we can find cases where it was a dry storm, a wind storm that didn't have rain, the wood stays dry, and yet they can't start their fires.
Around the same time that happened to the Nephites, wasn't there like some kind of destruction in Jerusalem when he died?
There was an earthquake, as he mentioned over here, that rent the veil of the temple, but it didn't destroy the temple, okay. And it didn't destroy, we don't read of a destruction of a lot of buildings or anything. It was just an earthquake of probably, it doesn't sound like it was a major earthquake, but it was big enough to do some damage.
Couldn't they estimate like the time of that earthquake and compare it to the time of a volcano during the Nephites? And
you know, if we had really good records, we probably could. But we don't. Our records aren't that accurate, unfortunately.
Okay.
Good idea. Anything else? Well, thank you very much. Appreciate being with you today.